Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at theelmstreetgroup@morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today is Glenn Normando, Executive Director of New Hampshire's Fish and Game Commission. Like the name indicates, Fish and Game is the state agency governing hunting and fishing, but it has much broader responsibilities too. Habitat management, non-game wildlife, public boat ramps, and these days, lots of search and rescue missions. In fact, Fish and Game expects to hit a record number of these operations in fiscal year 2017. Already, it's been involved in almost 180 rescues, which is normally the total for an entire year. Today in The Exchange, Fish and Game Executive Director Glenn Normando is with us, and let's get your questions in. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Director Normando, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Laura. Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into all the issues, including funding and the budget and hunting and fishing and all the other stuff you guys do in the great outdoors, what's the most common misperception people have about New Hampshire Fish and Game? What don't they get about what you guys do?
I think probably just the variety of things that we are involved with. You hear a lot about search and rescue. Obviously, you have conservation officers in hunting and fishing, but we also have a wide variety of education programs. We have, as you mentioned, all of our non-game. We're responsible for all of the marine fisheries work, as well as dealing with commercial fishermen, lobstermen down at the seacoast. We permit things like oyster farming down at Great Bay, which is huge right now. So it's really the diversity of the things that the department is actually responsible for what's relatively, you know, a small number of people, actually.
Do you need a new name? Because Fish and Game really sounds like Fish and Game, and that's kind of it.
It does. It resonates with our traditional folks, and they want to keep it that way. It's of course, in statute, so any changes would require its change in law in a myriad of places. I'm not sure that's a battle I'm ready to deal with.
And with the funding situation, you probably have other battles to fight, and we'll talk about that.
There's always battles, yeah.
Well, I think a lot of people might imagine you rescuing orphaned bear cubs, up north, or stalking fish in some remote pond. But I wonder, Director Normando, if you ever show up in downtown Manchester or on the streets of Nashua or Portsmouth.
I was in the job about 3 or 4 days when I got a call at home on a Sunday to let me know that there was a bear in a tree in the center of Rochester.
Really?
Surrounded by people and a camera truck from WMUR, and the bear was clearly stressed, and it happened to be up a tree that was surrounded by one of these rings of iron.
Like protective wire to prevent squirrels or something.
Which were all pointed, sticking straight up in the
air.
So I had some horrible visions of how the department might look. And it all turned out fine. We were able, once the crowd had dispersed and it got dark, to needle a bear, catch it in a net on its way down, and go put it where it belonged. But So we've had several of those types of episodes, you know, bears getting in the downtown area or in that sort of thing. We also have some programs in those areas. We support Amaskeg Fishways, for example, which we're busy reintroducing river herring, which has been very successful. We're having several hundred thousand returning now, and at least last spring at this time, the fishway, if you were down in there, was solidly packed with returning herring. So we're working with herring and shad restoration in the Merrimack, and it's having a fair amount of success.
Well, let's talk about one area of your mission, Director Normando, where a lot of people are aware of what you do, and that's the search and rescue missions. And one of your officers told our Morning Edition team recently that you're expecting to hit your typical annual number of rescues soon. What's going on?
Well, I think several things. You know, the economy's better. People are out recreating. We had so there's more people out doing all sorts of things. Search and rescue, everybody thinks of it as a high mountain type of scenario, but it covers a lot of instances of everything from, you know, we had some very unfortunate drowning accidents with snowmobiles this past winter, and it's our responsibility to recover those victims. we've had a lot of snowmobile crashes.
There were a lot of snowmobile accidents.
There was.
We
had record snowmobile registrations this past winter, and I think that was some pent up demand. There wasn't much snow the year before, and people get out there and get a little carried away, often at night with a few adult beverages in them, and bad things happen. You know, the mountain stuff, people just get up in there unprepared. The spring is classic because the weather can be fairly decent down at the bottom, and all of a sudden they're in waist-deep snow up high and unprepared. And then you got to go find them. And if the weather's going south on you, it can be very difficult. They're off the trail. It's hard to pinpoint them. If the weather's bad enough, the helicopters can't fly. So it can be pretty difficult.
Who does these rescue missions, Director Normando? Because from what I understand, you know, you've got like three dozen people total in terms of staff. So you must have some volunteers who help you out.
We do. There's several groups in the North Country that we would be in trouble without that are, you know, volunteers that we train with. We have our own rescue, and of course it takes precedent. So they drop, you know, the COs drop everything else. Usually the lieutenant for the area will take charge of the scene and act to coordinate. But, you know, it's very circumstance dependent as to how many people you need and how, you know, if you know exactly where somebody is and you can just go get them and lead them out, great. But if you have injuries where people need to be carried out.
That's often
long
the case,
distances,
isn't it?
Then you've got, you know, that's a lot of work, you know, to carry somebody 4 or 5 miles out down the mountainside.
In the snow.
Can take 20 plus people because you can only go a few yards before you need to shift off. And so that, you know, it runs the gamut of requirements. And thank God for all the volunteers that are involved in that type of situation.
Well, for a long time, there's been a debate in New Hampshire about, you know, making hikers pay for these search and rescue missions. Where does that stand?
Well, frankly, it's pretty much a losing proposition. We if you're negligent, you know, we can still bill you. And so what happens with those is that we have a system whereby if the lieutenant or sergeant running the search thinks that, you know, that there is negligence, they'll write it up. We'll have it reviewed by the Attorney General's office. And if they agree, then the people will be billed the exact cost of the rescue operation. Frankly, you know, we have a lot of people that simply don't pay, can't pay. You know, you end up, you know, trying to chase them in court. It's all very difficult. And the returns, it probably costs us more to chase them than the returns.
And it's not great PR for the state of New
Hampshire.
And
it's not
either.
Great PR for the state. And frankly, some of the most expensive searches have been fatalities. And so regardless of the circumstances that led to those, you know, if you really want to give the state a black eye in the media, try billing somebody's family that was, you know, killed. I mean, it's not really a feasible situation. So now we have instituted the hike safeguard, and that has been far more successful than we anticipated. You know, based on a couple of other states, we thought we might see $35,000 or something like that. But last year, we got about $120,000 on those voluntary hike safes. I think the media coverage of these episodes in New Hampshire has been quite helpful to those sales. And it has definitely taken some of the it's taken up some of the financial strain that in the past we were dumping into the Fish and Game Fund. So.
Well, let me remind our listeners to join us. And then I do have a couple questions about paying for search and rescue, the hike safeguard that you mentioned, Director Normando. The number for you to be with us as we talk with New Hampshire Fish and Game Executive Director Glenn Normando is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Director Normando, Donna from Campton emails. She says, I'm wondering if any of the hiking rescues that did not have hike safeguards and were hiking without the correct provisions have been charged for the cost or the rescue, and if any of those have been paid. And so I think you already addressed that, right? I mean, It sounds like you don't really do that anymore.
Well, we do. We still do in egregious cases in some instances. But I can't tell you right off the top where we stand on where that number is and who's paid and who hasn't at this point. But, you know, worst case scenario, it essentially goes back to the AG's office for collection.
What's egregious in your mind?
Well, you know, when you have a scenario where someone goes up in those mountains at the wrong time of year, completely unequipped to handle it, and ends up in a situation where, you know, $6,000 to $8,000 to $10,000 is, you know, the cost of getting them out when they could have safely navigated the situation with proper equipment and some forethought. I mean, you know, that's where things get pretty, you know, sketchy. I mean, we have billed people for rescues where the bill is a few $100 because, as I said, it's not a fine. It's an actual cost scenario, and we just went and got them, you know. And it worked out relatively easily. But you know, it's these difficult ones with a lot of people and a lot of time involved.
And risk to the people involved.
And risk to the people. And you know, the fellow that we found the other, was it 2 or 3 weeks ago? There was a gentleman lost for 3 or 4 days. The helicopter time was $100,000 for
wow.
that search. Now, thankfully, the guard has been more than generous in working on that up his training and whatnot. If we had to pay those helicopter fees, we would be doomed.
When you say the Guard, you mean the National Guard?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Donna also says, enjoyed watching Northwoods Law. Hope it continues. And I'm going to ask you about that a little bit later. That's the Animal Planet
okay.
show starring you guys. But a little bit more on, you know, the hike safe card, $25 a pop. And then I guess the idea is, right, Director Normando, that if I buy a hike safe card for $25 and then something happens to me, I sprain my ankle, you guys come get me. No cost.
Right. Well, if you sprain your ankle, we probably are going to get you no cost if that's the only thing. I mean, yeah. Accidents do happen. We're looking, the issue is, did you really unintentionally screw up by not paying attention to what you should have done for, you know, equipment and whatnot?
Well, let's say I sprained my ankle because I hiked up Lincoln Lafayette in flip-flops, which, by the way, I have seen.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so there's a situation where, you know, that's not very bright, but the but that card will mean that, you know, you're essentially, you know, off the hook. And, you know, it helps us, you know, it helps us pay for the training and equipment that it takes to do these things.
Let's take a call. Steve joins us from Keene. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
As you said, I live in Keene, and I've been a volunteer at the Nadnock State Park in the past, and I've been involved in a number of rescues on the Nadnock, both with the park rangers and also with Fish and Game. And my comment was about the idea of punishing economically negligent hikers versus a carrot instead of a stick. And as satisfying as it is when you see people do really stupid things, I think in that case, the horse has already left the barn. And it punishes, you know, if you give someone the cost of a helicopter search, it's punishing a few individuals severely, but it's not doing much to deter all those other hikers out there. That's why I think the idea of educating hikers ahead of time is a better approach.
Okay, so a carrot instead of a stick. Thank you, Steve, for calling in and for your work in terms of volunteering.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Monadnock is that's a major hot spot in the southern part of the state. I mean, it's on big weekends, that place can be a zoo of people with, you know, having injury problems and whatnot. A lot of heart attack issues come out of there. But I agree with him. It's, you know, and we have on our website complete information, not only on how to, you know, get yourself a card, but what you should be taking and what you should think about. And, you know, unfortunately, it's tough to, you know, you can't individually contact every individual that's going to be out there hiking around. And so we need to, you know, we have to hope that they'll take it upon themselves to do a little research at times.
Well, thanks a lot for the call, Steve. And again, on this Hike Safe card and the cost of search and rescue, here's an email from Brian in Antrim. He says, I'm a scout leader who brings youth into New Hampshire's backcountry. Brian says the cost of buying individual $25 Hike Safe cards annually for each scout is cost prohibitive. Can a group rate be developed? And Brian, good for you for getting the kids outdoors. What do you think, Director Normando?
I think you could develop anything. The card is a it's a creature of the legislature. It would take a change in statute. The fee and the card are all set in law. So that would be food for thought to have a state rep or senator propose a bill to make that an option.
So the legislature set up this program, including the fee. If you want to change, like a group rate,
you need to talk to the lawmakers.
Okay.
Exactly.
Real quick, Director Norman, what's the number one mistake that a lot of these hikers make?
I would say it's simply preparedness for equipment. Flashlight, batteries, compass, know how to use a compass, some extra clothing above and beyond what you think you'll need if the weather turns and, you know, you get cold, sleeping bag and some sort of a bivy tent is very helpful if the weather turns cold and freezing on you and you need to dig in and get out of it.
More on that after a short break, and we'll take a lot more of your calls. Steve, thank you for that one. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Keep it right here.
I Ideas come naturally to writers.
I wish.
But how are they with deadlines?
I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like, if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it.
Apparently, they're just like the rest of us. Whether you're looking for inspiration or commiseration, subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Fish and Game director Glenn Normando is with us on his agency's role in New Hampshire's great outdoors. As we're hearing, it's about a lot more than just hunting and fishing. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Director Normando, just to wrap up our conversation about search and rescue, you guys have been doing a record amount of these this fiscal year. You said that the Hike Safe card at $25 a pop really helps. It's brought in about $120,000 for your agency, so that's good. So is that enough?
Well, it's a good contribution. We also receive $1 from every registration of an OHRV or a snowmobile.
OHRV is an ATV?
ATV. ATVs and snowmobiles each put $1 in their fund, as well as $1 from every boat registration. So you combine that all together, and we're getting there. However, there is still an overage. The search and rescue account is in the negative every year, and that means, you know, we still pay the bill, so it defaults into our base fish and game fund, whatever the difference is. In some years, it's been well in excess of $100,000, which, you know, if it was 1 year, it'd be one thing, but guess what? Over 10 or 12 years, you know, you've taken $1 million-plus out of the fish and game fund that shouldn't have really been used for that purpose, and so... It's a long-range, you know, a long-range problem, which I don't know if we'll ever completely cure it, but, you know, certainly education is the way to help it.
From what I understand, Fish and Game is largely funded still by fishing license fees and hunting license fees. Do you guys get any money from the general fund
like
a regular state agency?
In the biennium we are in right now, we were given $600,000 a year out of the general fund. That's in about a $30 million a year budget, so it's proportionally fairly small. Hunting and fishing license is our in the vicinity of about 9.6 to 9.8 million a year, and we get around 7.5 million in PR and DJ funds, which is a federal trust fund, which the revenues of which come on excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment. So again, the sportsmen are actually, you know, paying that money into the federal government, and it's coming back to the states. So, and then there's a variety of, you know, other fees and dedicated accounts that also come in to fill in the rest of the budget. For example, the boat access account, we're responsible for all the state boat ramps, and which we have somewhere around 140, and there's a $5 fee on every boat registration that comes into the department to for purposes of that process.
One of the concerns that I've heard from you in the past and others who work in this field is that as fewer young people get into hunting and fishing, there's just fewer dollars flowing into fish and game departments here in New Hampshire and around the country.
It is true. If you look at, we are, depending on who you listen to, the second or fourth oldest state in the country. If you look at the median age in New Hampshire and as it's flowed through the years, you can follow the median age of hunting and fishing license holders also. And so that in the long run, it can be problematic. And, you know, and it's pretty difficult to beat the to beat the age issue. And unfortunately, we have sort of a net migration out of young people to the state. And
even if they were staying, though, would they hunt and fish? And
well,
that, like,
yeah, the cultural issues are something also separate of it. And, you know, my son is 22, and he's going to be a senior in engineering school next year. And, you know, he loves to hunt and fish, but especially on the hunting side, when we go out when he was in high school, he had no one to talk to about it. I mean, Portsmouth High, you know, hundreds of kids and none of them do it. And so it's we're really working on that. We have something called R3, which is retention, recruitment, and re-institution, where we're trying to get people figure out the dynamics by which we can get young people interested in and out there. And
well, and other efforts too to broaden the base beyond hunters and anglers.
True also,
and that's,
you know,
been a big conversation and controversial at times. And
right.
I want to dive into that with you, Director Normando, but also go to our listeners. Raymond is joining us from Londonderry. Hi, Raymond. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling. Raymond, are you there? Oh, we lost Raymond. All right. Well, Raymond, hopefully you call back. The number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at @NHPRExchange. So let's talk about that effort to bring in a broader array of people. You know, you mentioned earlier how wide your portfolio is, habitat restoration and public boat ramps and all sorts of stuff like that. I read about a new group, Director Normando, called the New Hampshire Wildlife Coalition that was trying to bring more folks in to kick in more money beyond the hunters and the anglers. Who else do you think should have a seat at this table and maybe put some dollars on that table?
Well, I think that the public writ large should have a seat at the table. I mean, we, whether you hunt or fish or not, we hold fish and wildlife in the public trust, okay? They are the property of all the people of the state. And at the same time, the sportsmen writ large, hunters and fishermen, have been the driving force of conservation in this country since Teddy Roosevelt started it all off at the turn of the century. And virtually everything we have here now, whether it be, you know, say turkeys, the last turkey I'm aware of, wild turkey, was last seen in New Hampshire was in 1853, I believe. And we have turkeys everywhere you look today. Well, it was hunting and fishing dollars that brought turkeys back to New Hampshire. And it has been, you know, people, we know we have moose issues at the moment, or issues with the moose population, but as late as the 1960s, there were only about 100 moose in the state of New Hampshire. So, you know, it's...
we have about 4,000 today, roughly.
Yeah. And then and the same could be said with our white-tailed deer population. So there is while everybody owns a piece of this pie, it's been sportsmen who for a century have really funded the states to do the work they do on the ground to put to basically save fish and wildlife in this country during a period when no one else cared about it.
Sure, and that's been the conversation. How do you broaden the pool of fiscal responsibility for maintaining habitats and maintaining wildlife and so forth? So who should kick in some bucks, Director Normando?
Well, that's a good question. And I think...
What are some of the ideas
that
have been
out there? Well, personally, I think everybody should kick in some bucks. The real question is, how are they going to kick in the bucks?
Sure, through a licensing fee, through the general fund.
Exactly.
There was a big debate, gosh, I must have been, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years ago about a kayak tax. You know,
right.
Canoers and kayakers don't pay a boat license fee like motorboat people do.
Exactly. So that's where, you know, I think most people understand that And I'm not talking about just New Hampshire. I mean, almost, not all, but almost every other state's faced with these very same issues relative to, you know, fish and wildlife. And it's really, what's a fair methodology to help? And also, I mean, the ups and downs of annual appropriations can also be, you know, difficult to deal with. I mean, because one of the things that people have to realize, fish and wildlife, our time horizon to get things done in fish and wildlife that's meaningful is much farther than any of the political time horizons related to running for office in this country. I mean, it took us, where are we at now, from 1975 to today to get turkeys to where they are. So, you know, buying land, it can take 10 years to take a piece of land and turn a habitat into a place that will be suitable for our endangered New England cottontail rabbits. So when you're trying to work the funding program, which naturally is dovetailed with the politics of the day, and understand the time horizons it takes to get this good work done, it makes it very complicated, and everyone has their own ideas, of course.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And there have been a lot of discussions, again, around, you know, who should kick in more for fish and wildlife restoration, as you said. You also mentioned turkeys, Director Normando, and here's an email from Alden in Deerfield. When will Fish and Game increase the turkey tag limit? I have had eight hunters tag out on our farm, which barely makes a dent in huge turkey flocks. Increasing the length of the season makes no difference at all, since all but one hunter tagged out in the first 3 days. Even Vermont has increased to two turkeys in the spring. Every farmer I've spoken to in the state feels the turkey population needs to be checked, and it's annual agenda item for Farm Bureau. But we feel like Fish and Game is ignoring this issue. Wow, Alden, the very interesting story. Now, for the uninitiated, you're going to have to explain what Alden means by the turkey tag limit.
So when you to hunt turkeys, you have to buy a tag, okay? And when you are a turkey permit, when you get that permit, you're allowed to take one turkey in the spring and one turkey in the fall. The turkey in the spring basically has to be a male, and the fall turkey can be either sex. And our fall season is limited. Well, there's a long archery season, but only a few are taken by archery. The shotgun season's a week. We actually expanded it to include a weekend this most recent year. It is, I think, likely in the not-too-distant future that we will, in fact, increase the number of spring tags, at least in some areas. At the same time, I go back to this time horizon. People are looking at what's out there now. We look back and remember when there was not a turkey in the state, and that means that you'll find your average wildlife biologist to be fairly conservative about where we go, because
they remember that.
Well, and if you overdo it, it can take you a long time to get back. And
how hard is it to reassess, though? I mean, we've got Alden saying, you know, farmers in his area feel like they're being overrun with turkeys. I almost hit some on my bicycle, you know, a while back in Concord.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
No, I didn't. But, you know, doesn't seem like we're lacking in turkeys.
No, it doesn't. I agree with you. But again, it's that conservative streak in the biologists. And you know, we do our rulemaking for the big game species every 2 years, and I have a feeling that when the next rulemaking round comes up, that'll be a significant topic of conversation.
All right. Well, Alden, thank you for the email. I'm sure a lot of people have seen some of the turkeys that you have seen, so I appreciate you jumping into our conversation. Let's go back to our callers, and Gordon's in Milan. Hi, Gordon. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Sure, go ahead, Gordon.
The question is, why has South Pond and Stark, New Hampshire, not been stalked in the last couple of years by the state record? And and also Nash Stream. You guys are doing a real nice job up there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It is beautiful. I've been to Nash Stream. You know, I'm glad he called because some people might not realize some of the fish that you catch are stalked by Fish and Game. In fact, there's some cool videos on your website of Fish and Game officers coming in a helicopter and stalking one of the ponds.
Right. We do remote fish pond stalking at numerous ponds by helicopter. They're stalked as fingerlings, so they sort of grow up naturally in those ponds. And I honestly didn't quite catch his first...
South Pond and Stark, why that is not stalked.
South Pond and Stark. I honestly would have to check on that.
Okay.
I'm not familiar.
Well, we won't answer your specifics, and I apologize, Gordon, but I'm glad you raised the issue. We also got an email on that same issue from JJ in Keene. I'm a teacher in Keene, grateful for the education outreach programs from Fish and Game. In partnership with Trout Unlimited volunteers, we've raised eastern brook trout from eggs provided by Fish and Game to give my students a chance to learn about life cycles and stream ecosystems before releasing them into a brook within walking distance of the school. JJ says now that their classroom fish are living there, these 10 and 11-year-olds feel a deeper connection with that water body and a stronger awareness of the need to keep the watershed clean and healthy for wildlife. So there's another example of the stalking.
Right, trout in the classroom thing has been a big hit.
Well, and I'm sorry, Gordon, that we couldn't answer your specifics, but I do wonder, it raises the broader question, Director Nomado, how do you decide which ponds to stock and which ponds, you know, maybe we won't stock this year?
Well, a lot of it goes to what is the situation in the pond itself. Is it a warm water fishery? Can it be two-tiered? You know, trout need cold water to survive through the year. And, of course, we stock in the rivers also, as well as the lakes. We stock about 1 million fish a year, and we have 6 hatcheries. It is a real process. And the stocking and the stocking rates are all developed by our fish folks. And we have just hundreds of ponds and bodies of water that we put fish in. Some put and take, some with the idea they're going to live there for a few years and get big, like all the salmon fishing in the lakes. So it's hard for me to talk about any one specific pond.
But, sure. Well, Gordon, again, I appreciate the call because it does raise that broader question. What would happen if you didn't stock?
So if we didn't stock, what you would find is we would still have brook trout, although they would tend to be small, mostly living in streams. We would eventually lose our salmon because we have very little natural spawning of salmon in the lakes. It's pretty much all done in the hatcheries. And you would probably lose significant, a lot of the trout fishing around if there was no stocking at all. The warm water fisheries, bass and whatnot, they do a good job taking care of themselves and they're in more productive waters. But the trout fishing would go downhill pretty significantly.
Well, and to our earlier conversation about funding Fish and Game, there was a caller who couldn't stand the line but really wanted to know if there are license plates people can purchase that help benefit Fish and Game.
There are, and that would be the moose plate, which we get a piece of the money from that is used in our non-game program.
Okay, I want to thank that person for the note. Lots of other emails, Facebook comments, and calls that we'll take after a short break. And we'll hear a little bit about that TV show, Northwoods Law, whether Director Normando has ever been in an episode of it. We'll talk about that after a short break. Stay with us.
I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, New Hampshire Fish and Game Executive Director Glenn Normando on his agency's mission from hunting and fishing to search and rescue. Let's hear from you, your questions and comments about the work of the Fish and Game Department in New Hampshire's great outdoors. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Director Normando, here's an email from Margaret in Concord who says, I hope there will be more episodes of Northwoods Law, New Hampshire. The conservation officers and search and rescue groups were a great reflection on the department and our state. What's been its effect from your perspective? And before you answer Margaret's question, for folks who don't know what Northwoods Law is, it's an Animal Planet show. And the latest episodes featured New Hampshire Fish and Game. I just want to play folks a little clip from the show.
This is like the Wild West of New Hampshire.
We are the outdoorsmen. We have the woods lore and the knowledge of the state.
I'm talking right now. Just listen to me. That was ridiculous.
Did you kill the deer? Tell me the truth right now.
We have mountains, seacoast, and everything in between.
Being a game warden is very different than any other law enforcement.
Whew.
All right. Well, again, that's a clip from the Animal Planet show, Northwoods Law, New Hampshire. It makes it sound like a lot of fun, Director Normando. Wow.
Yeah.
What about Margaret's question? What's been the effect of this show?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that in terms of effect. What I can say is that we put – there's six episodes out there. And I haven't heard a bad word yet about any of them. The crew is showing up Thursday to start filming for the next round. So I'm not sure how many episodes they're going to put together yet, but there is going to be another round. I think of at least 10 or a dozen, if not more.
You guys showed them a pretty good time the first
round.
Yeah,
so exactly.
Were you at all concerned, Director Normando, when, you know, this TV crew showed up and it's their goal to make things, you know, exciting,
well,
as we heard in the clip?
We have pretty much total editorial control over what they show.
Because, really?
Yeah. You know, we review each episode several times before the final cut's done. And we know personally the guys over in Maine pretty well, and they did 72 episodes over there. And we spent a lot of time talking to them about issues that came up to so that we would learn what to do and what not to do before they came over here.
You want to give us an example?
Well, just, you know, I don't know that I have any specific examples, but, you know, things that you don't even think about, you know, the COs, for example, are always mic'd.
So, conservation officers.
So, right,
yeah.
So, you know, you have to pay attention to what you're doing.
Got it. Right.
And the
don't say anything you wouldn't want on the air.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like the old saw about emails. You know, if you don't want to have it read in the paper, don't write it. But there's a learning curve. The other thing is we have tried to make it more than just a cop show. Okay, those versions have been almost all conservation officers or game wardens, depending on the state. We have tried to put in a piece in each episode about other facets of what we do. So the fish stalking from the helicopter was one. If you saw the episode with the rattlesnakes.
I did not see that.
Yeah, okay. So people don't even know we have rattlesnakes.
I thought we did not have rattlesnakes.
No,
I'm a little disappointed
probably,
to hear that.
It is probably literally our rarest animal in the state. We may only have a couple of dozen of them left. And we have radio transmitters surgically implanted into some of them so that we can find them and track their life. And there was a episode that actually had the most positive comments was that I've gotten was on that rattlesnake episode.
Have you been in any of the episodes?
Governor Hassan made it quite clear that if we were going ahead with this, I was to stay out.
How come?
Well, I might be one of those that makes a slip, you know.
Okay. Well, let's set that aside. And thank you very much, Margaret, for the email, because I did want to ask about Northwoods Law. Back to our callers, and John's calling from Hopkinton. Hi, John. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, Laura.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, this is John Cantor. Hello,
oh,
Director.
Hi, John.
That's my boss there. I just wanted to mention on the funding issue that, you know, in the non-game and endangered species program, we don't get any of the hunting and fishing license fees, and,
right.
and some of the hunters want to know that record is clear, that
yeah.
we do not get hunting and fishing license
Good
fees
point,
for
John.
Non-game program. But we get generous donations every year. You know, we're getting over $100,000 from over 1,000 individuals who just donate money year, many of them year after year, some of them for 30 years, that the program's been in existence. So I just wanted to mention that's a tremendous source of support for non-game and endangered species program, along with the moose plate that you mentioned before. And there's a growing pot of some federal funds for doing that work. In a particular note, this past year, we got our first estate donation, half of the estate, a gentleman who actually had worked at one point in the hatcheries for the department, left half of his estate, about $50,000 to the department for its work with non-game and endangered species. So I just want to recognize that.
Okay.
The contributions that those people make, those donations
well, John,
every
thank
year
you.
To help us out.
Sure, and thank you for the call. And, you know, back to this point about funding, since John raises it, Meg on Facebook asks, why don't kayakers and canoes need an annual boat registration to use state ramps and launches too? Meg says, I'm a kayaker, and I appreciate the access.
Yeah, well, that's a... I believe it was in 2007 we had a bill in, and I was on the commission at the time, and we got our derrieres handed to us in the legislature on that. Everyone came out of the woodwork and just chopped at our knees right out from under us on that. So,
what was the argument?
That they shouldn't have to pay, you know? And, you know, when you're used to not having to pay for something, it's, you know, it's a tough gig. So, you know, whatever. I mean, that was a fight that we lost on heavily.
I want to ask you about the moose hunt, Director Norman Doe, and I believe the application deadline for a moose hunting permit is this Friday. So let's talk about that a little bit. And, you know, we hear from people who say, look, the moose are struggling. You see pictures of them. They're skinny. They're being devoured by ticks. Why are we even hunting these animals?
So, again, almost all the moose research that we've done, pretty much every bit of it I can think of, is hunter paid. It is also most of what we know about moose physiology is coming from the moose that we get hunting. We put biologists at the check sites, and that's how we determine things like tick loads, the weights of females, their productivity, a lot of the biological information of how we understand moose comes from that. That being said, I think we're only doing 50-something tags this year, which means 36 to 38 animals will probably be taken in the hunt.
That's way down.
We're still killing over 100 a year on the road. So road kills are still way above, you know, any kind of... The hunting rate is virtually negligible in the world of moose. Hunting mortality, I should say. And again, we get a lot of our information out of that. And the I should also say that the moose population is about where it was when we started the hunt in 1988.
It's about 4,000 now?
Yeah, 3,500, 3,800, something in that. You know, it's tough to know, you know, to predict exactly. It's not zero, and it's not going to be zero. But, you know, if we don't control the climate and what's going on, moose are a northern, very northern animal. New Hampshire's always been at the southern edge of its range. And a lot of these parasite issues are associated with that, being really kind of too warm for them.
Sure, because the ticks don't die out in the wintertime.
Well, that's right.
Well, a couple emails on that. Sharon says, I understand that our diminishing moose herd is due in part to tick infestations. She says, if the herd is diminished, why is hunting them not stopped until they repopulate? And I think you just answered that. But she also says, are there any studies or programs to address this? And there is. We're nearing the last year, right, of an ongoing study between Fish and Game and UNH. We've funded
UNH with federal Pittman Roberts funds to do this study. Interestingly, our survival this past winter has been much higher than the rate over the last several years because, you know, anecdotally, it's because of last year's drought.
Yeah, we did a whole program on ticks yesterday.
Right. I know.
They
I listened
did not
to
like
it.
The drought.
Did not want me to go outside. I was listening to it, and I was like, ooh.
Yeah.
And however, that drought really knocked the socks off of the winter ticks. And the tick loads going into the fall were much lower on the animals that we looked at the that had been taken in the hunt. And lo and behold, we only lost around 30% of our calves over the winter, whereas the previous couple of years we've been losing about 70% of them.
You know, to the earlier, I think it was a Facebook comment about boat access and our kayaker who says she appreciates that public boat launch site. We often hear Director Normando complaints from listeners that they feel shut out of some of New Hampshire's nicest lakes, that the shoreline is all tied up by private property owners, even though the water technically belongs to the public. So what's the fair way to do this, to create a boat launch when there's no public property, but the public owns the water?
Well, we try to find properties and that we can purchase and put a site in. You know, again, that fund is reaching the point where we're at the limits of what we can actually accommodate. We're trying to put in, you know, probably would be our last big lake boat site at Sunapee right now. People around the lake are fighting it.
Why are they fighting it?
Oh, you know,
they like the peace and quiet. They're afraid people will come in and make noise.
It goes on and on. It's been a 20-some year struggle.
It takes 20 years to build a public boat launch?
Yeah, it took 20 years for us to get one on Squam. You know, it's, believe it or not, there's only, you know, we own the only real state boat launch on Winnipesaukee. One on all Winnipesaukee. So it's a struggle. It's a struggle, and it's expensive, and then it's expensive to maintain everything, and so permitting hasn't gotten any easier. The process is long, and it gets tied up forever in appeals, people fighting it, court cases. The Sunapee deal, I think, has been to the Supreme Court a couple times, so it's all fun.
Stick one more call if we could. Mike's in Berlin. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah. I got a few comments. Like, as far as these hikers, a lot of the hikers we get up here, you know, all they'd have to do is ask locals, for one. I mean, I've lived up in the North Country forever. I've hunted and fished all my life. And we know the conditions probably better than even the meteorologists because we live here. We know. So we can tell a person, hey, it's not safe to go up there, you know, and if you're not prepared, like he said, you know, you're going to land yourself in a whole lot of trouble, and then people are going to have to go and get you, which risk their lives on top of that. They have no knowledge of the the terrain they're playing with. They don't realize that. We got a lot of steep stuff up there. There's a lot of areas if you're not fit to be climbing them, you shouldn't be climbing them. I mean, that's just common sense. But we get people up here year after year doing the same thing, climbing Mount Washington.
In shorts and flip-flops. Yeah, and I've seen it myself. Mike, I appreciate the call. It's tricky, though, Commissioner Normando, isn't it? I mean, your agency is also heavily involved in trying to get people outside, especially young people, so that, you know, children don't grow up with no experience.
Tourism is the second biggest industry in the state. And you know what? We live and die financially on our tourist industry, whether that's at the seacoast, up in the mountains, up to Pittsburgh, whether your thing is hunting, fishing, hiking, going up in the mountains, snowmobiling, ATVs. I mean, you know, everyone's got their own gig. It's just with some, it's like, don't let common sense hold you back, you know? Just a little common sense could occasionally make a big difference.
If you don't grow up in a hiking family or a camping family, and then a friend of yours says, hey, let's go hiking, and you say, sure. And, you know, on the one hand, your agency would probably cheer that. Great. Someone else is, you know, learning to love the great outdoors. But as our caller says, you know, sometimes they don't have the knowledge they need. So
yeah,
it's inexperience.
Well, I used to have an employee in my old life who used to tell me the definition of experience is that which you get after you needed it.
Yeah, after you learn the hard way. Yeah. Mike, I really appreciate the call. You know, speaking of bringing in new people and so forth, Director Normando, the commission itself, I was, you know, doing a lot of research yesterday. I clicked on a picture of the Fish and Game commissioners. With all due respect, they're all older white men. You know, some of my best friends are older white men. It's not a knock against older white men, but
I happen to be one.
but you know, there's no women, there's no young people, there's no minorities. What efforts are you making to diversify those people who make up fish and game policy here in New Hampshire, and to open it up to new generations of people?
Well, you know, it is open. We've actually had trouble filling vacancies. It's nothing. It is not, you know, those are governor's appointees, and they're confirmed by the council. So the director has no real role in selecting or confirming commissioners. You know, it's a process that's set in the statutes as to what the qualifications are and how you apply for it.
So you have to have a certain experience and expertise.
Well, to some extent, and you have to have held a hunting or fishing license for five of the last 10 years. So it's a political process.
All right, and I got to cut you off there. We could talk a lot more about that. I really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.